Greetings, this is Keith Preston from Attack the System, and this is a new podcast project we're experimenting with, and we'll see how this goes. Our name is going to be called Kick the Puppy, because we're going to kick lots of puppies, hopefully, on this program, where nothing is sacred, and we're going to hopefully offend everyone. If you're not offended, let me know, and I'll be sure to include you next time around. Our longstanding contributor to Attack the System, RJ Jacob, is here with me as well. Hello, RJ. Right on. Okay, so let's do this. We're just going to talk about some of the stuff that's going on in this crazy world we live in. So over in Britain, Jeremy Corbyn now is supposedly making an insurgency within the Labour Party. And there was an interesting article in New York Mag about this by Andrew Sullivan. Andrew Sullivan is a longtime neocon commentator. That's really all that needs to be said. When you hear the word neocon, you know what I'm talking about. Andrew Sullivan is talking about how Jeremy Corbyn is bringing back what he calls the face of the new left, and he's arguing that Corbyn is taking the British Labour Party back to what the left was in the 1970s. Reading over the article, this was in New York Mag on dated August 2018, I have to agree with much of what Sullivan is saying, in the sense that Corbyn does have an ideology or an outlook that's very similar to what the left actually was in the 1970s and 1980s. He's from that generation, and while Corbyn is older than I am, I to some degree am from that generation. And the left, as Sullivan is describing it in this article, and the left that Sullivan says was the left of the 70s and the kind of left that Jeremy Corbyn is trying to bring back in Britain is a lot like what the left was back in the old days before this all of this social justice warrior and Antifa stuff and all this other kind of stuff started to take over the left. It's interesting because the left today in much of the Western world is not really the left. It's really a kind of neoliberalism. And the left, you know, what passes for the left really acts, I think, in many ways as, you could say, stooges for neoliberalism. And by neoliberalism, I mean the corporate class and the overlords of the global economy and the techno oligarchs and all of these different kinds of things. And it's these elements that are pushing all the anti-Russia hysteria we see today. They're the ones behind all this political correctness nonsense. So it's interesting to see what Corbyn is doing over in Britain. And there are other movements that have developed from the left end of the spectrum in recent times as well. I'm not going to try to pronounce some of these people's names correctly because I always butcher foreign names when I try to pronounce them. But there's a fellow named Melanchthon in France. He's from representing the far left. There's a Wegenacht, I think is how you pronounce her name, Sahara Wegenacht in Germany. And again, this is another approach to the radical left that's somewhat similar to what Corbyn is doing. There's also Five Star in Italy. Five Star is actually one of my favorite political parties anywhere in the world today because it's a very maverick party, and it's a party that is introducing a lot of interesting ideas from sort of a kind of hybrid radical left, radical center perspective. And now they've now actually joined the Italian government in coalition with a right-wing party. So it'll be interesting to see where all this goes. But check out the article in New York Mag about Jeremy Corbyn if you're actually interested in left-right politics, because it makes some interesting points. Another news, the techno censors are at it again. We see that Alex Jones has been kicked off of a lot of social media. And it's interesting because in the discussions that I've seen about this, about the Alex Jones situation, there's a lot of people out there who just seem to hate Alex Jones so much that they're really glad to see him getting his due. I'm not sure why Alex Jones would be such a reviled figure. I could understand if it was David Duke or somebody like that. But a guy like Alex Jones just seems to me to be someone that's more of an entertainer than a serious political thinker or somebody that really promotes any kind of political ideology. I mean, watching his program is kind of like watching a program about UFOs or something like that. His views are so far out and so ridiculous. I could never really understand how anyone would take Alex Jones seriously. But I mean, even if he is entertaining. But apparently he's been kicked off of a number of social media forums. I mean, he was kicked out of YouTube. He was kicked off of, I think, Facebook. There was an article on Medium.com by Caitlin Johnstone. Caitlin Johnstone is an Australian writer, a kind of a leftist, a traditional leftist. similar to someone like Jeremy Corbyn. And she talks about this. She talks about how the left is now defending the silencing of Alex Jones and saying, you know, who do you think they're going to come after next? And this is a real blind spot, again, that a lot of people on the progressive end of the spectrum seem to me to have nowadays. I remember the days when the left were the people who were the zealous defenders of free speech, and they would even defend free speech for people they didn't like. Like, I remember the American Civil Liberties Union, a liberal organization, if ever there was one, they defended the right of the American Nazi Party or one of the groups like that to march in a Jewish neighborhood back in the 1970s. I remember when Oliver North was put on trial for things related to the Iran-Contra affair, the ACLU defended his Fourth Amendment rights, I think it was his Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. So the used to be that the political left would defend even people they didn't like on free speech or civil liberties or constitutional grounds. But nowadays, that's not really the case. Nowadays, we see that the political left is going out of its way, it seems, to cheer on efforts to silence people that they think are right wing or conservative or anything like that. And of course, the problem with that is that those kinds of weapons are always used against you eventually. What's happening is that the system is trying to shut down the voices of anyone that promotes any kind of dissenting perspective. I came across an article a while back talking about how the Facebook had been shutting down or removing posts from Facebook at the direction of the American government and the Israeli government. You know, so those are really the folks that are behind a lot of these kinds of things. And it's interesting how the left is functioning as the useful idiots for the essentially for the international ruling class. But that's something that's been going on for a while, and I've written a lot about it. You can go to read my books or read my old articles at attackthesystem.com, and I've criticized the left quite a bit from that perspective.
You know, I think we have to point out that, like, at the end of the day, there's nothing you could really do about big tech giants censoring people. And I've seen a lot of anarchists, they say, well, hey, look, these are private companies. You know,
the tech companies really are, to today's world, what the industrialists were in the 19th century. In the 19th century, you had John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie and people like that, you know, the captains of industry that really were de facto states unto themselves. And today, it's the tech companies really serve that same kind of role. The techno oligarchs are emerging as the new elite, the new ruling class. The old ruling class that was based on things like industrial manufacturing is in a state of decline. We have this new technological and financial ruling class that's emerging. Like, I was looking at an article the other day talking about the wealthiest people. The three wealthiest people in the United States are Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is an investment financier. Bill Gates, his wealth is in technology, as we know, and Jeff Bezos, it's in e-commerce. And there's also people like Zuckerberg. So the techno oligarchs are really the new ruling class, the new robber barons, comparable to what the 19th century robber barons are.
Right. And the thing is, people don't realize how much money we're talking about. Like, you name the top three richest guys. I mean, when we think of things like normal distributions among people, like, let's say height, like, you're a pretty tall guy, right? If you were to say that you're 8% taller than the average, that means you're just a tall person. Now, if you were to say you're 60% taller than people, you'd be like the tallest guy in the world, right? Well, wealth is so different than this that most people can't comprehend it. If you were to, like, to really get a grip on what we're talking about, to have, like, a visual on this, if you were to take all the richest guys in the U.S., put them in a room, okay, and start counting, one, two, three, and each second represents 1 million. Everybody sits down when you call their net worth, okay? Well, by the time you got to about 17 minutes, most of the 1% would be sitting down by the time you get to like 17, 15 minutes or in that neighborhood. Billionaires would have to start sitting down when they hear their net worth, okay? Donald Trump, okay, according to what we know about his worth, he'd have to sit down at around an hour. Then a day later, the second day of billionaires sitting down, Bill Gates would sit down, okay? Warren Buffett would have to sit down. So that's, you know, to get an idea of how ridiculously rich, even in comparison to the 1%, it's really difficult to comprehend.
There's a video on YouTube, I can't remember what it's called, but it's about wealth inequality in the United States, and it actually lays this out statistically pretty well. It talks about how We've got the poor, we've got the working to middle classes, and even a lot of people that are considered upper middle class or rich are poor compared to the super rich. It talks about how the top 0.1% are not just super rich, they're like super rich. You know, their wealth is comparable to that of whole countries in some instances. And the back to what you were saying, though, about public spaces, cyberspace is the new public space. I mean, cyberspace is like public parks and those kinds of things. It's like a public venue that in which people interact in the same way that they did on a person-to-person basis in past times. Not only that, but a lot of the tech companies are piggybacking on infrastructure that was created by the government, like the internet. And so essentially a lot of these companies have also profited from intellectual property law and patenting and all these kinds of things. I think we could make a case, at least we could make a reasonable, not maybe a foolproof argument, but a reasonable argument that things like the First Amendment should apply to tech companies as well as institutions like universities in the same way they apply to government. Like when the U.S. Constitution was first written, it only applied to the federal government. It didn't apply to state and local governments, which to a degree made sense because the states were considered to be almost like independent nations back then. But as the states largely became just an administrative unit of the federal government, the courts started extending the First Amendment jurisprudence to include the states and localities as well, and the Constitution generally, not just the First Amendment. And a case could be made that in today's world, we need to extend that to corporations, particularly tech companies and communications companies, as well as to universities, because these institutions are really states unto themselves. I mean, these are the institutions that control the means of communication, and controlling the means of communication and the means of and the public space generally is really the means of controlling discourse. I think we could compare the tech companies to either something like a public park, or we could compare them to state-owned media, that is media that's directly owned by the state, like the BBC, like Russia Today, like Al Jazeera. All of those are networks that are owned by a government somewhere. And while we theoretically have privately owned tech companies, they're not really private. I mean, they're heavily intertwined with the government. They get a lot of privilege from the government. They have the means of influencing the government. They are using infrastructure created by the government. So that's just a thought. There's an article in Counterpunch that's interesting. It talks about Donald. I mean, it's interesting in the sense that it's kind of silly. It's an article by some guy who, his name is Nick Pemberton, and he describes himself as a student at Gustavus Adolphus College. He is currently employed by Gustavus Dining Services. So this guy is obviously some kind of social justice warrior. He writes for Counterpunch, which actually Counterpunch used to be a decent web journal back in the day when the late, great Alexander Coburn was its editor. But it's veered off into SJW, Antifa, Russiagate territory in subsequent years. But it's interesting because he has this article called Donald Trump and the Rise of Patriotism, as if patriotism didn't exist before Donald Trump. And this guy is actually trying to make the argument that Donald Trump has unleashed some new wave of fascism or something like that in the United States, which I think is silly, because if you actually look at the kind of stuff Donald Trump does, if this were the 1970s or really even the 1990s, he'd be considered just a normal politician. He's enacted some protectionist trade policies, which virtually all Democrats used to be in favor of, and even some Republicans, like even Ronald Reagan, implemented some protectionist trade policies for the motorcycle industry, for the automobile industry when he was president. Donald Trump, I mean, he's pursued summit meetings with the heads of state of Russia and China and North Korea. It used to be all presidents did that. I mean, Richard Nixon did that with Leonid Brezhnev and with Mao Zedong. Jimmy Carter did that with the Deng Xiaoping and with Leonid Brezhnev. So there's nothing abnormal about that. It's like Donald Trump now is considered to be, I mean, I'm not a Trump supporter. I didn't vote for him and I didn't vote for anybody, but nobody is always the best candidate. You know, it's like, really, it's the us non-voters that are the largest political demographic. 46% did not, of eligible voters did not vote in the last election. You know, so nobody actually got more votes than Hillary, and nobody got more votes than Trump. So nobody's really the largest political demographic if we want to look at it from that way. But what I do think is interesting, though, is the way that the left has reacted with such hysteria. I mean, not just the left, it's just liberal opinion, and even some neocon types have reacted with such hysteria over Donald Trump when he's really pursuing policies that are just straight out of the playbook of Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton. I mean, plenty of other presidents we've had before. If anything, he's fairly liberal on certain things, if for no other reason, because the culture has drifted leftward, you know, like gay marriage and the states legalizing marijuana and stuff like that. So it's interesting to see how Donald Trump provokes such a reaction. In other related news of the absurd, I came across an article about this incident that's going on in Little Rock, Arkansas. And this stuff is funny. Apparently there's an issue in Little Rock, Arkansas, where the local government, you know, it's Arkansas, so it's a deep red state, so of course it's very Christian and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, in those areas, there's always a dispute about putting religious monuments on public property, like, you know, nativity scenes and, you know, Ten Commandments replicas and things like that. But apparently there was a Satanist group that was trying to claim, well, if other religions can have public monuments, so can we. And they wanted to put up a Satanist monument of some kind. I don't really know exactly what it was, but apparently apparently a court ruled that they could do this, or because, you know, due to on a basis of equal protection or something of that nature. But there was a protest that went on over this statue, and there I found this one article. Now this is from the Roper Report. This is a guy named Billy Roper. He's a far right wing neo-Nazi or something like that. But the headline is hilarious. It's titled "White Nationalists and Christians Face Down Satanists and Antifa in Little Rock." I mean, that sounds like something out of the WWE or something. It reminds me of, you know, the Road Warriors and the Sheep Herders take on the Fabulous Freebirds and whatever teams there would be. Yeah, so white nationalists and Christians face down Satanists and Antifa and Little Rock. I mean, what more needs to be said? I mean, that's just as silly as it gets. So that's really the state of political discourse in the United States at present. We have these rival teams of cults out here protesting against the statue. And the thing is, the statue, if you Google it, it's a really ridiculous looking statue. I mean, it looks like something that was like a throwaway from the set of some fourth-rate science fiction movie or something, or like some drawing out of some amateur comic book or something. It's just really ridiculous that anybody even gives something like this a second thought. But then you have all these people out here protesting against some kind of satanic statue in Little Rock, you know. And again, it's all the usual suspects, you know, the white nationalists, the Christianists. I guess you've got the Islamists in some parts of the world, and we have the Christianists here. And, of course, the Satanists, it's interesting to see they're getting involved in the political discourse. We usually don't hear much from them. And, of course, there's the Antifa. I guess the Antifa showed up because they heard the white nationalists were there or something like that. So much for that. There was an article in USA Today about a shooting at Walmart. And this happened in Pennsylvania. It says eight. This is the headline. This is from USA Today. So this is the mainstream media. Eight injured at Walmart in Pennsylvania after shooting in checkout lines. Now, I think if anything, a headline like this in many ways reflects the state of our society. I mean, these are the kinds of things people like to fight about. People get into a shootout over who's going to get it cut in line at Walmart or something like that. But actually, the reason I'm talking about this is because I was actually reading about Walmart recently, and apparently Walmart can be a pretty dangerous place. Like, there have actually been hundreds of incidents of serious crimes taking place at Walmart, like things like murders and rapes and abductions and armed robberies. Now, some of this is not customers and employees. I mean, some of it is just, you know, Walmarts are huge facilities, and you'll have people that do an armed robbery or murder in the parking lot or something like that. I mean, that happens. You know, but this isn't really something, this isn't the kind of stuff you normally associate with a retail store. You know, normally you think of people getting in a fight and shooting somebody in a bar or a nightclub or a strip joint or something like that. But at Walmart, yeah, that's pretty interesting that there's actually a lot of this stuff that happens at Walmart.
This guy was so high. He said he was awake for like 5 days. You know, there's a picture of him, and he just looks so smoked out, like walking dead, burnt out, stressed out, going into a meth-induced temporary psychosis. He was probably hearing voices. My favorite is when they crashed into the back of an empty cop car. Folks, be responsible adults. Don't smoke meth.
Well, Walmart, though, is interesting because, you know, another thing they're known for is their Black Friday riots. Like on Thanksgiving weekend, on the day after Thanksgiving, when they have the Black Friday sales, they've actually had riots where people get killed. They get trampled over, you know, who's going to get a discount on new underwear or something like that. Right. So, I mean, it's like Walmart in so many ways symbolizes what's wrong, you know, the downside, the underbelly of American society. I mean, this is like a superstore, a conglomerate with that's, you know, a plutocratic empire on one hand that, you know, like years ago, I remember reading where a union organizer said that, you know, Sam Walton, the Walton family, they made billions of dollars creating the kinds of jobs that if you have three of them, you still can't pay rent. And that really, it says a lot about what the Walmart business model is, you know. And it's like I came across another article some time ago talking about how many billions of dollars Walmart costs taxpayers because their workers are so poor. So many of them are on food stamps and you know, public health care and all this other stuff, you know. So it's essentially Walmart has a 19th century business model. You know, it's like the kind of business model that we associate with the company towns from the 19th century, you know, where you have the big, big company that dominates the local economy or squeezes out its competitors and everybody works there for slave wages. You know, it's like Walmart is the, you know, the mate one of the 21st century.
And you can go to any Walmart at any time, anywhere in the U.S., and find at least a half a dozen, maybe a dozen people living in the parking lot.
Right.
People living
right.
in the cars there, you know, because Walmart provides public space. You'll see RVs there, people living in the Walmart parking lots. I know a guy who worked at Walmart and lived in the parking lot of Walmart.
Well, I was just going to say a lot of them are probably employees. A lot of them are probably employees. But, you know, I actually read about a case probably a couple of years ago where there was this woman. She was a fairly young woman. I think she was probably in her 20s, maybe her 30s, and that held four part-time jobs in these kinds of places like convenience stores and superstore chains. Because the thing is, a lot of these places don't hire full-time workers, at least not for their rank-and-file workers. They'll hire a whole bunch of 20-hour-a-week workers, and that way they don't have to pay any benefits or overtime, health insurance, and that kind of stuff. And that's more and more the model of labor a lot of businesses are using nowadays. But there was this young woman that was, I think she was a Hispanic woman, that was actually sleeping in her car in between jobs, but she was sleeping in the parking lot at a gas station, and she ended up inhaling accidentally carbon monoxide from a nearby gas pump or something and died from carbon monoxide poisoning. So she literally died sleeping in her car in between part-time jobs while like basically living in the parking lot of a gas station.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, you know, that, I mean, that's like something you expect to happen in Venezuela or something like that.
Yeah, that's tough. You know, and it's a really difficult thing to do, to try to live out of your car. I remember reading a study, I don't remember where it was, or it was a couple of years back, about how many people who want to work in Silicon Valley, they want to be these tech guys, they will go there thinking they could live out of their car and then end up on the streets of San Francisco, you know, when they realize that it's not as easy as they thought. I've lived out of my car before. I remember I walked into a construction company in Reno called Square One Solutions. I walked in, I put my license plate number down on the job application where they asked for a physical address. The guy I saw that, he liked that, he hired me, and 6 months later he hired my brother. So that is a tough kind of life, and these things do happen.
Okay, now this article I was talking about earlier about the three richest Americans, that was actually in Forbes. I found that. That was actually in Forbes magazine. You know, Forbes, of course, is the big business magazine published by the Forbes family. In fact, one of the Forbes tried to run for president some years ago, Steve Forbes, but it was actually Malcolm Forbes that Malcolm Forbes was an interesting guy, though. He was out, you know, he was this filthy rich guy. He was also gay. He was like well known for doing gay cruising and that kind of stuff. And he actually died of AIDS eventually. So it's but Malcolm Forbes is the founder of Forbes magazine. But there's an article in Forbes about these three richest guys in America. And they're talking about Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and Jeff Bezos. And it says that they collectively hold more wealth than the bottom 50% of the domestic population of the United States, a total of over 160 million people, or 63 million American households, right? So, you know, roughly, according to this article, roughly a fifth of Americans have zero or a negative net worth. And yet these guys have, you know, more wealth than 50% of the nation, which is astounding. You know, again, this really is the 19th century model. This is the kind of stuff that went on during the Industrial Revolution, where you had, you know, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and all of these different kinds of robber barons, Vanderbilts, that accumulated these massive industrial empires, and then you had all of these workers that were working in their slave-like conditions in factories and mines and workshops and all of those kinds of things. It's also interesting to go back and read about what labor conditions were like in the 19th century. You know, it's interesting how violent labor relations were. In fact, a friend of mine recently was talking about reading up on labor disputes that happened in the 19th century, talking about how he had no clue as to how violent some of this had been. This really is the kind of system we're moving towards, this kind of 19th century model plutocracy, the kind of thing that we have traditionally seen in Latin America and countries like that. You know, we've got the super, super rich who have this opulent lifestyle, beyond anyone's imagination. And then more and more people are, you know, living in their cars and camped out in tents on the sidewalk and that kind of stuff. Let's see. Oh, speaking of poverty, there was an article in the Boston Herald, again, mainstream media, officials were complaining about how people were living illegally in rented storage units. So people are, you know, I mean, the reason people do this is obvious. I mean, it's a hell of a lot cheaper to live in a storage unit than in a house, particularly somewhere like Boston, which is extraordinarily expensive. It's an expensive metro area. So what people were doing is renting these rental spaces, and it talks about how people, you know, were actually making a home for themselves. They had curtains and coolers and food and electric cords, and of course the local government in Boston had to come in and take a dump on this. You know, they were complaining about how, you know, the usual stuff, it doesn't fit zoning regulation and housing regulation. And, you know, this is really an issue that a lot of the libertarian types get it right on. A lot of the libertarians talk about how one of the problems we have of homelessness and excessively expensive housing is that housing is just so hyper-regulated. I know in the city that I live in, which isn't comparable in terms of the rents and all of that kind of stuff to some of these larger metro areas like L.A. and San Francisco and New York. Now, I live in Richmond, Virginia, which is a secondary city. But for years, though, I've noticed this in Richmond, that you have the more politically connected business and real estate interests, that they're always trying to jack up their real estate values. And they do that by trying to squeeze low-income housing out of areas and stuff like that. And they do it by regulating housing to death. They put so many regulations on the use of land and buildings and building codes and all of these kinds of things that it makes housing extremely expensive. And it's really bad about that in some areas. I think probably sectors of the West Coast tend to be the worst. But the larger cities generally, this tends to be a problem. So, yeah, but apparently you had a lot of people that were living illegally in storage units. Of course, in Los Angeles, they tried to ban living out of vehicles. Because so many people were doing it in Los Angeles. There were people living in RVs and cars and stuff like that. And other places where people have set up tent cities and these kinds of things, they're trying to crack down on that as well. So that's an issue.
Yeah, they make it illegal to sleep in the city. That's how that works.
Years ago, when I was involved in municipal activism around some of these kinds of issues, I used to call this the compulsory suburbanization of America, in the sense that they basically expect everyone to live a suburban lifestyle. It's like, no, you've got to have a house and a yard and all of these kinds of things, or you can't live anywhere. You know, or you've got to rent a high-priced apartment because everything else has been zoned out of existence or regulated out of existence. So yeah, I mean, this is interesting how this kind of class conflict is emerging. Okay, so speaking of that, California, there's an interesting article. This is one of the articles you sent. This is from Slate. It says, California is deteriorating into a feudal society of inherited land wealth. And there's a sociologist that I think is very interesting, a guy named Joel Kotkin. And Joel Kotkin has a number of books where he's talked about this. He's talked about what he calls the new class conflict in America. And it's related to some of the stuff we've been talking about, how the new ruling class is becoming these techno oligarchs. The Mark Zuckerbergs and companies like Google and all of that kind of stuff, they're becoming the new robber barons. And along with that, we're starting to see a 19th century, early 20th century model class society develop. And Joel Kotkin argues that this is more advanced in California than virtually anywhere else in the country. And it's interesting, I guess that's where all these tech companies, or a lot of them, are located. And Kotkin has a number of articles that he's written where he talks about this. He talks about how in California, you have the very, very rich in places like Silicon Valley and Malibu and Beverly Hills and the Bay Area that are as rich as the rich anywhere. And then increasingly, you're having this massive underclass of poor people. Now, some of that is migration. Some of that is people coming up from Mexico and Central America who are already very poor anyway. But there are now regions of California where the level of poverty rivals that in sub-Saharan Africa. I saw some data on that a while back. But, you know, you will find pockets of poverty in California that match that of the Congo, which is interesting. And Joel Kotkin has argued this, and I see this in an article like this in Slate as well. Let's see who wrote this. It's a guy named Henry Graeber wrote this, but he's talking about how California is becoming a feudal model society as well. Which is the kind of system they've always had in Latin America. And more, I think the rest of the United States is moving in that direction. California tends to be the bellwether for the United States and a lot of trends in a lot of different areas, culture and economics and technology and all these kinds of things that start in California tend to migrate eastward and become the norm. And that's where class relations, again, seems to be going in the United States. So that's an article called California is Deteriorating into a Feudal Society of Inherited Land Wealth. And I'd recommend Joel Kotkin, by the way. Joel Kotkin, K-O-T-K-I-N, Joel Kotkin, written a lot about this. Let's see. The New York Times is an article titled California's Birds Are Testing New Survival Tactics on a Vast Scale. So what the hell is that about? Climate change?
I think so. I'm pretty sure all creatures everywhere are testing new survival tactics on a vast scale.
Yeah.
Right.
I've seen articles that are apparently this is really happening. Apparently this is credible science here, not just some fringe thing, where the dumping of certain kinds of chemicals in the water is actually causing deformities among fish and stuff like that, including gender alteration and things like that. So you're actually having like transgender fish or something like that.
Yeah, I see a lot of stuff coming out about the fish. I don't really like to hear about the fish. My feelings on the fish are like, you know, I mean, we have no connection to fish whatsoever. When you look at a dog, for instance, you have a dog or you have a cat, it's like we have a connection with the dog or with the cat, right? We look at the fish, clone gassy like little marble eyes just looking back at you. There's just nothing there. There's just no connection. I mean, when was the last time you ever heard about an article about fish saving a human life? Or you hear about dolphins assisting human life, or, you know, because they're mammals. But the fish, I just really don't care about the fish. You know it?
Yeah, we don't really, even a lot of vegetarian, you know, vegan animal lover types, they still eat fish. You know, that's interesting. It's not quite the same type of thing as, say, hurting a dog or a cat or something like that. These kinds of domesticated animals. Speaking of which, this was interesting. A few months back, I posted an article on Facebook, and this was about, they have this dog eating festival in China regularly. And, you know, I mean, that's just a delicacy in Chinese culture. They eat dogs. And this was an article about, you know, Chinese people having a dog eating festival, and they were cooking dogs and that kind of stuff. And it was some pretty gruesome photographs in this article about how they were skinning dogs and eating them. I mean, it's not any different than what we Americans do with cows and pigs and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, from the point of view of American sensibilities, you know, where dogs are these house pets, domesticated animals, you know, it was some pretty gruesome stuff. But I know when I posted that, what the article actually was a petition where you had these people, animal rights people, that were trying to send a petition to. They actually wanted to petition President Xi Jinping and China to shut this down or prevent this from happening or something like that, which struck me as pretty silly. But anyway, when I posted that article probably got more negative reaction than virtually anything I've ever posted. I mean, I've posted literally thousands and thousands of articles on Facebook over the last probably 5, 6, 7 years. And this article really got like an outpouring of, you know, how can you post something so horrible, or what kind of depraved people are these, you know, these kinds of things, including, which is interesting because I regularly post articles with all sorts of war crimes being depicted, little kids with their limbs being blown off. And you know, I posted a video yesterday of a Palestinian girl that had been shot in the face with a bullet by the IDF. And that kind of stuff doesn't really get that much reaction. It's more the dog cruelty to animal thing that actually gets more reaction, which is interesting.
Yeah, nobody cares about the Palestinian kid. People love their dogs. And, you know, a lot of homeless people eat dogs, too. Like in some cities, it's actually legal to start a fire. And so a lot of people will capture dogs, twist their neck, and literally skin and cook a dog and eat it. And a lot of Asian people eat cats and stuff, too. I know you go to Chinatown around here, there's no cats anywhere in the entire Chinatown area. It's a real thing. It really happens.
Yeah, there was a controversy in my local area some years ago. We had a judge for one of the lower courts, and there was some kind of case involving a dog that ran away or a missing dog or something, and the judge said during the hearing, he said, well, I hope it didn't end up at a Chinese restaurant or something like that. And then, of course, people got pissed off and said he was being racist against Chinese people or something. But, they really do that. All right, so what else is going on? 80-year-old grandma busted for weed in Michigan. Yeah, the whole weed thing is interesting now, what's happening with that, because so many places, I think something like 9 or 10 states have actually legalized weed, including for, I think, commercial sales of weed in some places like California and Colorado, Washington State, maybe some others. But you still got this huge black market for weed. I was reading another article about that today where they were saying that even in places where weed is legal now, a lot of people still prefer to get their weed from black market sources because it's just better weed. You know?
It's cheaper.
It's cheaper, yeah.
Did you see in that article they actually took this woman to jail?
Oh, yeah.
They took her to jail. I think I don't remember what he was responding. An officer was responding to a call about car trouble. It had something to do with a car, and he knocked on the door, and somebody opened the door, and he saw like a loaded bowl or like a couple pipes with some weed or something. But this lady's name is Dolores. Like, there's no young people in the world anywhere named Dolores. You know, whatever judge signed the arrest warrant or the search warrant should have looked at it and seen that her name was Dolores. and thought like you can't take an old lady to jail for smoking. It was something about like her cannabis card was expired. She hadn't renewed the cannabis card, and they took the woman to jail. And that's why, you know, you get a lot of people who they want us to believe that we should be reasonable people when it comes to the cop question. That we should say, hey, look, these guys got tough jobs. They deal with a lot of bullshit. They got to make quick decisions, you know, on the fly, and they do the best that they can. But at the end of the day, they really don't make some of these. I mean, this is an 80-year-old woman named Dolores.
Yeah. The whole cop thing gets interesting because, you know, I post a lot of stuff on social media, you know, like Keystone Cop Capers, you know, including some serious police brutality cases, as well as just shootouts between cops and criminals and, you know, all the usual stuff. And, you know, I usually don't make any judgments about some of those cases. I'm just like, well, just watch the video or read the article and decide for yourself. But yeah, you know, it's like, you do hear that. You have some people saying, well, you know, the cops got a tough job. They got to make tough decisions. Yeah, but they often make a lot of stupid decisions, too. You know, it's,
exactly.
And, yeah, I had a fellow one time who had been involved in dissident political activity and who had had some run-ins with the cops and things like that tell me that in his life experience, whenever he had any kind of encounter with the police, whether it was in a political context, you know, like a demonstration or civil disobedience or something like that, or whether it was in a non-political context. And it didn't matter what the race or ethnicity of the police were either. It could be a white person, a black person, you know, an Asian or Hispanic person, a female or a male. You know, it's always the same stuff. You know, it's always just the same cop bullshit. You know, so it's, you know, that tends to be how it goes. You know, it's like, you know, I mean, And cops are supposed to have certain discretionary powers, you know. They don't arrest every single person that they ever see doing any kind of violation. They don't have time or they do have these kinds of this kind of discretionary authority, but you still use it, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're running out of time here, so let's see what else is in the news for this week. Oh, a candidate for office in Florida admits she doctored her college diploma. There's this lady running for something or other. Let's see what the article here says.
Yeah, she said that she didn't intend to deceive or mislead. It's like, yeah, you did. Yeah, you did. You printed out a fake diploma. I wonder if it's actually like, you know, those big lotto checks, those life-size giant lotto checks. It shows her on the cover of the page, and she's literally holding it, and it's framed.
Yeah.
She's, I guess, like some kind of born-again Republican servant. And she says that she didn't want to drop out of the race because she wants to lead again by example, honestly. To be a born-again, honest person.
Yeah, well, on the other hand, though, a lot of college diplomas are worthless anyway, so, I mean, what does it really matter? I mean, would it be better if she had a degree in gender studies or, you know, advanced queer theory or something like that, you know? So, I mean, who really cares? You know, I mean, there's really a lot of college degrees that are legitimate technically, but might as well be fake. Okay, so I guess we're about out of time here. So this is the wrapping up our first installment of Kick the Puppy, where I guess if we were doing this show in China, that calling it Kick the Puppy wouldn't really have the same kind of impact. So would we have to call it something?
Eat the Puppy.
Yeah, Eat the Puppy. Well, no, they do that too, though. So So if you've enjoyed this first episode of our new podcast, Kick the Puppy, with myself, Keith Preston, and RJ Jacob, let us know. We welcome your correspondence. And we'll be back soon with another episode. Mm-hmm.